Welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining us for the third day of our coverage of Nothing Lasts Forever, which is the penultimate episode of Season 11, Episode 9. And back with me again today is Darren Mooney. Hi, Darren.
What do you know? There is a morning after.
There really is, and thankfully so, because we're going to talk about Karen Nielsen and James Wong today, Darren.
Great, cool. And it's a really nice combination. It's a new writer working with an established director, which is very cool.
It is, and I mean, this has been one of the defining facets of this second half of the season, isn't it, really? That each episode, I believe, since episode 6, Kitten, has had a new writer. I think it was Gabe Rotter, and then Kristen Cloak and Shannon Hamblin, Benjamin Van Allen, and now Karen Nielsen. So I think it's been really interesting and mostly satisfying to have these new writers on staff and see what they can come up with. How have you seen it?
I'm really, really, really impressed with this. And actually, one of the more interesting things about this like divide between old and young in the season is, barring Followers, which is Followers is like a classic X-Files episode. Like it is a wonderful piece of work. But barring Followers, like one of the more interesting aspects of the season has been that you have the front-loading of the classic X-Files talent, like obviously Carter, the Morgans, and Wong. And what they're doing is they're doing shows that are kind of slightly different and off-tempo and sort of feel like they're, you know, trying to do something new with the X-Files. And then in the back half, you have like new writers who are taking, basically putting their own spin on classic X-Files episodes. That, I mean, like a lot of the episodes barring Followers in this stretch of the season are the ones that feel most like they could have come from the classic run of the show, which is absolutely fascinating and very clever and very cool, because it means that you have like, it feels like the writers are paying tribute to a show that they love, whereas the writers who actually worked on the show are like pushing forward and trying new things. It's a best of both worlds combo, I think, taken as a whole.
Yeah, I would agree. And let's start then by discussing Karen Nielsen, this episode's writer. Interesting bit of trivia. I mean, she had a short film called Grace, which was included on the Season 10 DVD and Blu-ray set. And I watched that again this week just as a refresher. And it's an interesting little piece if people haven't seen it. It's only like 8 or 9 minutes long. It takes place in this kind of post-apocalyptic world, and the protagonist is a young girl. So yeah, people should check that out if they get the chance. Have you seen it, Darren?
I haven't actually seen it. I did watch her short film, or the pilot, or you know, sort of like introductory premise to her television series, which was, what was it called? Oh, it's Parker's Fall is the one I'm thinking of, for example. And you can find that online as well on Vimeo, on the Canadian film website as well, and that's worth checking out as well.
Yeah, and she's given an interview this week to sci-fi.com. She was interviewed by Tara Bennett, and she talked a little bit, I think, about how that short film Grace was included on the Blu-ray. And it just sounds like it was a nice gesture, really. And in terms of this episode, Nothing Lasts Forever, I thought it was interesting what she had to say about the scripting process, where she said, "I made sure to keep in touch constantly to let them know what I was doing. Gabe Rotter and Darren Morgan would always read my scripts and give me feedback, so they've been super supportive as well, keeping up on what I'm doing. I had to stay in Canada to write it, so I only got to work with them when they came up to do their episodes. I talked to James Wong a lot on the phone, and Glenn and Chris." So yeah, it's always interesting to hear that thing. I mean, particularly, you sort of think of Darren Morgan as being like an island unto himself, but it's really nice to hear when he's supporting other writers too, isn't it?
Well, I mean, Morgan has a reputation for doing his own stuff, but like Morgan was story editor during the third season of The X-Files, and would have obviously contributed heavily rewrites to Quagmire, I think it is. But I mean, even on the second season of Millennium, there are stories that people like Chip Johansson tell, where Morgan would read their scripts and he would provide notes and feedback that would actually really insightful. I think there's a great story from, I think, Trip Johansson writing one of his scripts, where he gets a note, on his final scene, and the final scene was supposed to be like Frank Black, you know, being alone in the wilderness, and the note comes back and says he should be crouching by a lake. And Johansson's like, "I don't know why, but that just works beautifully." And it's like, that's it. So I think there is something very good, to be honest, about the use of the X-Files, the use of like the veteran writers and producers as like mentors for like a new generation of television writers. And Nielsen's obviously got a lot of raw potential based on what we've seen here, obviously based on her short film that was good enough that it was included on the Season 10 Blu-ray. But like, there's a wonderful sense of like developing young talent, and I like that in a show. I like that The X-Files is not just bringing back people who have already written X-Files. It's instead saying, here are new voices, and not just voices of like established writers, but voices of people who have interesting things to say, and using the X-Files as a vehicle to allow them to say that. Because one of the great things about the X-Files in its prime was it was a great avenue for young writers to come up and to learn the art of television. I think Gilligan likened it to be, you know, going to film school except being paid to do it. And it, like, it produced a whole generation of writers and showrunners and, like, directors and, like, people who would shape the television industry for years afterwards. And it's great that when the show came back in, like, 2016, 2000, well, not 2016, but in 2018 for its 11th season, that it's still doing this. That maybe for Nielsen, or maybe for Rotter, or maybe for Cloak, this will be like a starting point for something, and you'll get a TV series from them down the line, and you know, you'll have them interviewed by the, you know, the Emmys for their archive of television, and they'll be going, yeah, I remember when I started on the X-Files and Carter gave me a chance, and you know, I got this wonderful feedback and this wonderful environment, and I learned so much because, you know, there are these people who have these experiences, this pool of 20 years of television experience, more for people like Morgan Wong, and obviously for Carter as well, who worked at Disney beforehand, and they're sort of sharing this and imparting it and allowing me to develop, which is, it's really, really heartwarming to see.
Yeah, and I feel that's how it should be, really. In terms of what Nielsen was striving for, though, I mean, she talked a little bit about the impetus for the episode, and she said, I need to have character moments because I know X-Files is very procedural sometimes with the Monster of the Week. I love the Monster of the Week episodes, but I also love character stuff, so that was important to me. So we succeeded in merging those two. And I suppose that's the question, really, about this episode, is how successful was that merging? So I think when you started speaking at the outset of the first podcast we did, maybe had one or two qualms about the episode in that respect. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, like, I think that the episode is, and I'm not a huge fan of, like, procedural, like, X-Files episodes. I think she's entirely right that what sets the X-Files apart from other television shows is that it's, you know, it has a loose form, but it's within that you have a lot of improvisation, a lot of room for character building. Like, you couldn't do Law and Order with the X-Files. You couldn't have, like, a Dick Wolf-style operation where the cast are expendable, as we discovered in the 8th and 9th seasons. But, like, because obviously, like, Mulder and Scully and who they are is a huge part of the X-Files as much as the cases they investigate, which was a huge theme at, say, the start of the 2nd season, start of the 6th season. But at the same time, I do feel like this episode maybe could have done with a bit more attention to, like, the plot mechanics. And I don't want to say maybe the procedural aspect of it, but the logic that gets you from, you know, A to B to C, rather than just going A see. You know, it's yeah. that conversation from Mulder's in church where by a mutual power A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. It feels like this episode was missing the bit where you get A is equal to B and B is equal to C and just jump straight to A is equal to C in some respects. But I mean, I love the character stuff, and we've talked about how much we love the character stuff, and I love the thematic stuff, and we've talked about how much we love the thematic stuff. So I don't think it's an unfair or unreasonable trade-off. Like, I don't think it's something that, you know, cripples the episode or makes the episode bad. Like, I think Nielsen should be incredibly proud of the work that she's done here, particularly as a first-time writer for the show.
Yeah, I think so too. And of course, one of the trade-offs there is it allowed her to foreground, like, the religious aspect of this episode. And I thought this quote was interesting where she says, I've been fascinated with people that are very religious. My sister's very Catholic and I'm not. It's always been fascinating to me that Scully is very Catholic and Mulder is not. I pitched that I think it would be interesting to have Scully reflect on her religion a bit, especially with what was going on in her life with William. And then Glenn thought a cult would be a really interesting way to juxtapose that. And Jim was super excited too. So Glenn brought on the cult idea, and that is where I think the germ of the emotion journey came from. So, I mean, what do you make of that? Because, I mean, when I said at the outset, like, I think there's more to be derived from this episode for me than I have been able to. I think that's kind of what I was thinking about was the religious side of this episode, because in terms of, like, the iconography in, you know, of the church, stained glass windows and that kind of thing, and some of the biblical references, that's not something I'm massively well-versed on. I sort of need others to join the dots for me on that. But I don't know if you had any thoughts.
Well, I mean, the religious stuff is great, actually. I really, really loved it. And it's kind of cheeky and playful. And it's, like, it's interesting that, like, Glenn Morgan and James Wong pushed this episode, because I think, like, one of the things about most of the new episodes or the episodes by new writers is you get the sense of the veterans in the background offering a bit of guidance, a bit of steerance. So, like, familiar is very much a, you know, you can feel that Chris Carter maybe guided it and sort of, like, polished it and sharpened it a bit. like, because obviously it's got Carter's interest in, like, violence against children and themes like forgiveness and themes about, like, evil in small towns and stuff like that. This, in many ways, I think, had this sort of, like, more playful Morgan Wong thing. And, like, you can tell that with, like, the religious scenes, which are something that Carter's very interested in. But Carter's tone when it comes to religious scenes is a bit heavier. Like, you wouldn't get that sort of playful bantery, you know, Charlie was dying and I prayed for a puppy and I got a puppy. You wouldn't get that joke, I think, in Carter's handling of religion. Carter would be a bit more earnest. But you do have this sort of, like, it's interesting that she mentions Morgan pushing towards cults, because, like, if you look at the writing that Morgan's sort of done on the show, and with Wong, obviously, stuff like, for example, The Field Where I Died, which was the show dealing with, you know, like a Waco-style religious cult, or stuff like, say, his work on Millennium, where he took the Millennium Group, which was based on the Academy Group, which is a real-life, you know, criminal profiling organization populated by former FBI agents, and then sort of turned that into, like, this religious doomsday cult. It's very much something that interests Morgan as a writer, this sort of thematic connection. And I like that the episode sort of is playful and cheeky in that. Like, you have the opening scene where they're, like, licking the livers and where it's very clear that Barbara Beaumont is making smoothies out of these organs. And you cut to the church going, you know, and he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood. And you have this sort of, like, juxtaposition of, like, transubstantiation, which is the belief that, you know, which is the Catholic belief, which is distinct from the Protestant belief, that, like, when you eat a communion wafer, it is actually transformed into the literal flesh of God. When you drink communion wine, it's not a symbolic act, it's a literal act of transformation where the wine becomes the blood of Christ. And you have that sort of process juxtaposed between the two. You even have the wonderful, and again, Wong, we're going to talk about Wong as a director later on, but the wonderful visible juxtaposition of somebody putting out their hands to grab a communion wafer and the scene where Barbara cuts into the palm of one of her followers in order to get blood for, you know, her smoothie as the binding agent or whatever it is. And there's a lot of that really, really good stuff in there. And there's a lot of really sort of deep stuff in there. And there's a lot of, like, the episode acknowledges the power of religion and faith. And, like, well, this is one of the things that's difficult when you talk about faith, which is to talk about having doubt. Because I'm agnostic. I'm not a true believer, but I respect believers and I respect people who find power and meaning in their belief. And I have a great deal of admiration for people who find in their faith the capacity to do things that the other otherwise wouldn't do. And, like, my grandmother's faith was very important to her, even as she passed away. And I see a lot of that in Scully. I see a lot of, like, Scully's faith is a source of strength for her. And I think that the show, while it may, like, you know, there's perhaps some prodding of, like, organized religion and sort of, like, unquestioning belief and, like, you know, this sort of stuff in there, the episode is still respectful of Scully's faith. The episode never feels like it's mocking or questioning or, like, deriding Scully's belief in God, even as it does these, like, playful juxtapositions of, like, transubstantiation and literal cannibalism, which is something that is a little bit cheeky. And I feel like it's a very fine line for the show to walk, and I feel like Nielsen does it very, very well.
Yeah, I think she should be very proud of her work on this episode, personally. I mean, let's talk a little bit about James Wong, then. So his fourth episode of the series as director, I mean, the third of this revival era after Founders Mutation and Ghoulie. Yeah, let's talk a bit about his work here, because I thought there were some, you know, like, gorgeous shots and transitions here. So the one that really stood out to me was the moment where Scully dips her hand in the water in the church, and then you get the transition to Juliet, you know, and
the water is literal blood, like, as in, like, that's the transubstantiation. You have, like, this idea of the wine or the water that is, you know, the water is that is transmuted into wine in the Catholic, you know, story, and the wine that is commuted into the blood of Christ, which then becomes water and blood commingled, draining down the sink. And I mean, you know, I don't know how deep the symbolism is there, but it's a nice visual sort of, like, transition logically. It's a wonderful piece of composition. Like, Wong is a fantastic director. It's telling he's one of the few X-Files directors who's actually had a career directing, you know, successful blockbuster films, and, you know, the Final Destination series, and he did The One as well, I believe. Because he does. He has this really cinematic understanding of language. And the X-Files, really, what defined the X-Files in the 90s for me was the direction, which had a very cinematic style. It felt like a movie that you were watching every week. And, like, Wong's style is incredibly confident. And, like, that sort of transition is just so clever, but so effortless in how it's done in the episode.
Yeah, there was a real, like, elegance to it, which I found very impressive, you know. And, I mean, I don't think of the quartet of episodes he's directed, in the original series, he directed Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man. I don't think there's a bad episode among that bunch. But, I mean, where do you think this one rates in the sort of James Wong-directed canon, as it were?
It would probably be near the bottom, and that's no knock against it, because you got to keep in mind, like, Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man is one of my favorite episodes of television ever. I mean, Wong, I think, got an Emmy nomination for it, possibly, I believe. And then, obviously, Founder's Mutation was probably my second favorite episode of the original six of the revival series. And, I mean, even Ghoulie, I think, had a sort of a nice, sort of, like, playful classic X-Files feel to it, whereas this is a bit more... And we talked about it in terms of structure. It's these two lines that meet. It's the Mulder and Scully investigating, and it's the story inside the apartment, and eventually the two overlap and intersect. And, like, it's very well directed, and it has a number of those wonderful transitions in it. And, like, I mean, even the church scenes where Mulder and Scully are conversing under the stained glass window look lovely. But it doesn't have the same dynamism, maybe would be how I would describe it, as sort of Wong's previous two episodes for the revival. And it doesn't have the sort of, like, sheer beautiful artfulness of, like, Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man from the original series. But I mean, that's no knock on Wong. Wong is one of the best directors, I think, to ever work on the show, and that's an impressive accomplishment for a show that featured the work of, like, Bowman, Nutter, McLaren, and you know, obviously various other people as well. Manners, how could I forget Manners?
Yeah, I think that one thing I'd say is I think the switch in broadcast order works in this episode's favour. You know, I think there's a real value in having this contemplative, slow burner of an episode, really, coming before My Struggle 4, which I presume will be some kind of roller coaster ride, you know.
All on speed. I believe, like, I don't know, for listeners, I'm not sure whether or not this constitutes a spoiler, but Carter has suggested the possibility in interviews that this may not be a definitive ending of the show, and I kind of believe that based on my knowledge, based on my experiences, and I think every audience member's experiences of watching Chris Carter try to end a television show. I feel like, yeah, I am... How are you feeling about next week, Carl?
How am I feeling? I remain an optimist until such time as I'm given cause not to be. So one of the things that I expect to come into play, and which I thought should have probably come back into play sooner, was the revelation from the end of My Struggle 3, the cigarette smoking man talking to Skinner about William's parentage and so on. Yeah, I don't know. I think my concern is there's going to be so much stuff going on that sort of gets lost in the mix. I think that is a concern. But yeah, can you talk to us a bit more about what you thought of the end of My Struggle 3 and also what you'd expect or hope for Carter to do with that going into My Struggle 4?
I would be quite happy if the cigarette-smoking man's monologue from the end of My Struggle 3 were simply never mentioned again and we could pretend that it never happened. I mean, like, I understand... I don't want to get too bogged down in the particulars of that, like, decision in terms of writing. Like, I understand what Carter was doing in that, like, the X-Files was largely about, like, abstract body horror and the exploitation of women. And there's a large thread that runs through the original series that isn't discussed nearly enough about, like, women's autonomy over their own bodies. Like, there's a lot of stuff in there about, like, women's right to choose or women's right to, you know, to choose to have an abortion or to choose, you know, if they want to be pregnant or if they want to have a child or even their reproductive rights. Scully's attempt to assert control over her own ovaries is a big recurring theme. And, you know, this repeated theme throughout the show of the exploitation of women's bodies by men in power, which is done through the metaphor of alien abduction and obviously cloning and stuff. And, like, one of the things the revival series has done, and I admire it in general. I want to, you know, just in general, I admire, like, I like My Struggle 1 a lot more than most people do. And one of the reasons I like it is because what Carter does is he does in some ways what he sort of hinted at in Redux, which is he strips out a lot of the fanciful, like, flowery, sort of, like, pretendy, you know, sort of, like, cushions that you have in the mythology, which are like, well, aliens exist, and this is all about evil aliens, and says, no, actually, it's about people who are terrible, and it's about, like, people in positions of authority who are terrible and who do horrible things using that authority as an excuse to do that. And so I understand, in theory, why Carter would want, at the end of My Struggle 3, to say, basically, Scully was not the victim of alien experimentation. She was actually the victim of a powerful white man in a position of authority because exerting control over her bodily functions without her consent. In other words, basically removing the metaphor of sexual assault and transmitting it into a literal sexual assault. So sort of removing the sort of the distance that exists between the two. And I understand why Carter would do that. I still think it's an awful, awful choice, though. And again, this is partly because I feel Scully has suffered enough over the course of the X-Files, and I feel like as a character, there's very little added in adding this on top of her heap of indignity and suffering that she's experienced. But also because as somebody, like, as one of the five people who will raise his hands and say, I love the eighth season of the X-Files. I love the idea of William being a miracle, not born of the conspiracy or not born of the mythology, but born of the love between, you know, two people who are meant to be together and, like, who have had a horrible run of experiences in their life and just through some miraculous fluke, not only managed to find each other and fall in love, but managed to somehow, against all laws of, like, nature, and I mean, you know, this is a show, this is allegory, this is metaphor, it doesn't have to be literal, but managed to conceive a child through the power of love together and to found a family to replace the one that both of them had lost. I love that idea. And I feel like the revelation at the end of My Struggle 3 undercuts that and tears it away in the same way that, like, making Monica Ray as a bad guy does, where it undercuts a lot of the really good stuff that I think was there in the eighth season. So, I mean, I am very wary of that choice, and I'm sort of wary of where Carter might take that going into, like, the series finale. I am curious. I want to see what Carter's doing. I'm always interested in what Carter's doing. And, I mean, I've been, like, I think My Struggle 3 is the weakest episode of the entire 16-episode revival series. But I still think it's fascinating. I still think, like, Carter's mythology and mythologizing and the way in which he tells this story that he's telling about, like, the American experience in history through this story of aliens and Dyson spheres and conspiracies and virtual reality. I find it fascinating in what it tries to do, even if it doesn't always succeed. Part of me is worried that there may be another twist bookending My Struggle Part 3, which is the bit where it's all a dream. And I sort of, like, I'm worried that the show might be heading in that direction.
Yeah, I think that, on a couple of specific issues there, I think that Reyes is one thing that's disappointed me, because I was always willing to give Carter a bit of leeway there, but I thought she was going to appear more this season. I thought I'd seen Annabeth Gish tweeting that she was on set a bit more. Maybe it was just for reshoots or something, but I was kind of expecting to see her three or four times, and that hasn't come to pass. On, like, a nuts and bolts surface level, I think there's always been something in these My Struggle episodes which has stopped me getting fully immersed into them. And I think in My Struggle 2, for example, it was like these constant cutbacks to the Tad O'Malley show, which I just found really irritating. So, and then in My Struggle 3, you had Mulder doing a bit of monologuing, of course. And if there's nothing like that, I think that would constitute a step up, you know. So fingers crossed. All right, Darren, so thanks very much for joining me these last few days, and I think if all goes to plan, you'll be back with Tony to chew over My Struggle 4, won't you?
Yeah, it will be our struggle. Hopefully it won't. I am, as I said, you know, I'm willing to give Carter the benefit of the doubt. I am, you know, interested to see what he'll do, and it will undoubtedly be interesting. I don't know whether it will be good, but it will undoubtedly be interesting.
Yeah, and perhaps low expectations could work in this episode's favour, couldn't it, going forward? All right, Darren, so thanks very much for joining me. And listeners, the next podcast you hear will be our mailbag episode for Nothing Lasts Forever. And all being well, Clara Cook will be joining me on that episode. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at @X_cast or on Facebook. Go to X-Files Basement, which is our X-Cast podcast fan group. The end of the series is coming next week, but until next time, trust